Yeah, so last time I think we had kind of given the discussed the idea of this Teague functorial approach to topological quantum field theories based on these categories of Kolbe distance on the one hand, the category of Kolbe distance, and on the other hand, this category of Hilbert spaces. And also, I think I should make a few things a bit more precise. So we had, first of all, this category of Kolbe distance in n dimensions, where an object is just an n minus one dimensional manifold and a morphism, or actually, well, okay, let me be a bit more precise now. An n minus one dimensional manifold equipped with an orientation. So in particular, it has to be oriented, and there are a few things which one kind of has to keep in mind in that. But for example, last time we had kind of circles with what seemingly with so if we have the two circles, we can equip the circle with two different orientations. But the thing is, these are kind of still the same because these are still diffeomorphic in the sense that I can just kind of turn the circle over and map it to the other one so that I can map this orientation to that orientation. And so these are not really different in this category and COP, but these are isomorphic objects in that category. So in particular, it's not like we had said last time that this is kind of particle and antiparticle. There was someone speculating about these things and then this kind of annihilate, but this is.
You can only do this of turning one circle into the other one
Yeah.
if you live in a space of, I don't know, of three dimensions, four
No, the
dimensions.
thing is that these are abstract manifolds.
Ah,
These are not embedded anywhere. Right? So we have abstract n minus one dimensional manifolds equipped with an orientation. And so in some cases, a manifold is diffeomorphic to itself with the opposite orientation, but sometimes not.
Can you give an example where it's not?
So I've been looking into that, and so it seems that the easiest example. So I'm not sure about lower dimensions, but it seems that kind of a basic example is CB2, which is already four-dimensional. So this is not so easy to visualize. I haven't found an example where one can visualize it, but maybe there is one.
So what's the reason why it's not if you want the two?
So the reason I've seen was then something about the cohomology ring. That if you reverse the orientation, yeah, so something like that, and then you can see that this is you get different
It's not clear. We didn't
structure.
pinpoint where the problem is. Like, it's just like evidence that they're missing.
Yeah, so I can prove it, but I've seen the proof and seen that it has something to do with the cohomology ring.
And so you were saying that, like, last week, what Sensei was saying that the two different orientations could cause some different particles.
Yeah.
You're saying that that's not
No, that's not the case.
so. How? Yeah. So because they cannot, you cannot sort of identify the particles, or because what is the meaning?
Also, so it seems that these are more like you're supposed to think of this as kind of space on which the fields live. So this is not the particle itself, but this is a kind of a space of fields, and then when you have this pair of bands, it actually has to go this way. Then this is the space-time with kind of a topology change from this topology of two circles at time or at the initial time, so to speak, and this topology of one circle at kind of the final time.
So you don't really get to choose the orientation on a given time slice. Like when it attached cobordism, you have to you're forced to choose certain orientation to be compatible in an
Yes. Yeah,
abstract. So you don't get that freedom anyway.
Yes, yeah. So the morphisms in that category are then also oriented manifolds, n-dimensional oriented manifolds, and oriented in such a way that when you take the boundary, so the orientation on the whole thing restricts to an orientation on the boundary, right? And this restricted orientation has to be the given one on the objects. On the initial thing, And on the final, or on the codomain, it has to be the opposite orientation. In fact, the one restricted. And this guarantees that one can compose these cooperatisms in a nice way. So, for example, now, if this ends on an object, or on the circle as an object having this orientation, and we have another one, another cooperatism starting or having this same circle as a domain, we can just glue those together. But if the circle had the opposite orientation, we would kind of be forced to turn this around and plug this in on top. And this, then we would not get a manifold. I mean, this would not, we would not be able to glue this in a smooth way.
Is it like Klein bottle?
Well, Klein bottle doesn't live in this category anyway because it's not orientable. But, well, I mean, the Klein bottle is a manifold without boundary also, right? But trying to do this would leave us with some space in general having a strange boundary. A boundary which kind of branches then into two sheets.
So I guess that then the time doesn't flow, for example. So if you want to, you can like put arrows instead of, like when you have something like that, you can put an arrow in like that denotes orientation, like and on top. Or if you put this, then the somehow time goes back.
Yeah.
And so on.
Yeah, but more generically, you don't have a time flow. When you have like a manifold with two disconnected boundaries, and that's your cobalism, and you don't necessarily. And here it's nice because you draw it like that. More generically, you know, you can do more wide things. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have a direction.
It has a direction in the sense of an orientation only, but it doesn't have a time slicing or anything.
Yeah,
that's certainly not. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So just for notation, so cobordism is this gluing action, or?
No, the cobordism is this kind of interpolating manifold in between.
Okay.
So these are the morphisms in that category, and those we can compose by the gluing.
Is there a way that you can define an annihilation? Since you are talking about, some people are talking about antiparticle. I just wonder, as far as you know, as your knowledge you go, do you know any way to annihilate?
To annihilate what?
Say, you know, you want to consider particle, antiparticle.
Yeah, but then you would first have to define particles and antiparticles. But this is.
I'm not saying in this context, I just say in general, as far as you know, is there a way to define something like that? It's an open question. Maybe.
Not that I know of. But that sounds more like something going beyond the topological case, no?
Would it correspond to some picture like this? Where it's into the vacuum coming out and you have two circles, but I don't know the orientation, how they match or anything.
Yeah.
But you also have like sometimes like death things like this, right? But that, I think that this will be like two particles.
But there you also have, I mean, this is also a topology change, right? That we start from the empty space, so to speak, and as time evolves, we end up with these two circles, which can carry particles or not. So this is not, this is, doesn't necessarily carry any excitations or anything. This is just space and space-time.
So that's the standard point of view. And there's another point of view that you may think about such thing, especially if you have circles and a two-dimensional evolution. You may think of them as some kind of Feynman graphs or a string theory. So instead of particles, you have strings. And so the Feynman graph becomes, you know, some tubular worksheet like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can think of notions like annihilation, creation of loops.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a different point of view.
But can I think of Cambodianism as a war sheet, or is it actually different things? I think it's different. Can I think about this Cambodianism as a war sheet?
In this interpretation,
yes.
I suppose, yes.
About a war sheet when you have an embedding. Or,
yeah.
So I mean,
yeah.
The standard point of view is that this is your space-time, and you have P theory on it. And that should be a topological P theory. And I was just mentioning that in string theory, these are Feynman diagrams, and but it's not necessarily topological. So this is just a way to picture evolutions of string excitations. But these are different.
Yeah.
And then we also do something slightly different. No, we sum over all those then in order to
get
which we don't
no,
do.
So in this picture, these are space-time, just to make clear that these are not the excitations, but
yeah.
The space-time
uh-huh.
picture, so we stick with that.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah.
And the excitations, then we're going to have, I guess we're going to get to that then, well, and those are going to be this for example, connections over certain, well, kind of gauge fields on these are then going to be the excitations on these spaces and space times. Okay, so now in the functorial, so this is kind of the space-time or kinematical picture, and then the dynamics or the particular theory is then this functor, right? From this category to category filled spaces. Meaning that it assigns to every object a Hilbert space, which is kind of the Hilbert space of states on that space. So for example, to the two circles, it assigns a Hilbert space, which is the state space of these two circles. And to every cobordism, it assigns an operator going from the Hilbert space associated to the domains to the Hilbert space associated to the codomain. In a functorial way, in the sense that, well, it preserves or maps composition of covertisms to composition of operators, and maps kind of placing covertisms next to each other, which is the monoidal structure or the tensor product, and this category maps it to tensor product of Hilbert spaces and tensor products of operators in this category.
So you're talking about TQFT, not extended TQFT.
Yes. Yeah. So just to start with, we can also kind of do extended QFT would then be when we not only consider manifolds with boundaries, so which is like we have stuff in dimension n and in dimension n minus one, but also still lower dimensions we also allow boundaries of boundaries, and this sort of stuff. It's called and corners and manifolds with corners. And one can, in that case, then one can glue along even more general things.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what's discussed in this paper, in the paper of John Bass and Shane Stolen. So for today, I guess it would be interesting to look at particular examples of such functors. And how those correspond to the physics.
Just a little question. In that thesis also, they say that category of Hilbert spaces is not a good category. It's not, strictly speaking, a category.
Why not?
I think because of the types of morphisms. I don't know if you can tell me more.
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
What category of Hilbert space? See, page 17, the category. Object and Hilbert space and arrow are bound linear maps. This does not quite fit with the previous series, since arrow need not to be unitary. Well, and nevertheless, we shall see by choosing the general linear map is a more natural choice. So
page 17,
yes.
On top?
Top, yes, point B. The category yield of Hilbert spaces.
Since arrows need not be unitary.
Like it's not important, but
I'm not sure what that refers to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what is the previous series?
No, you know, it's a general category, so.
Mm-hmm. Does this say that it's not a category? It just says they changed the definition of Hilbert space. It doesn't say.
Yes, you're right, but there is a nuance here that you introduced, right?
I think they keep modifying the definition anyway.
That's just the beginning. Maybe that's not the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anyway.
Yeah, sorry. And well, another thing that I find confusing, and which I hope we will understand at some point, is that so the operators which this functor assigns to a cobordism, are in general not unitary. So this is pretty different than from what one would expect from the evolution of in a quantum theory,
right?
And he's saying this makes physically sense, and this is they should not be unitary because of the topology change. Does anyone have an idea of
what is unitary? First of all,
yes. Okay. So the thing is that in both of these categories we have kind of ways of taking duals. In the sense that we can take duals on the objects in each case. So for the cobordisms, we can, and for the n minus one dimensional manifolds, we can just reverse the orientation.
Mm-hmm.
That's an operation which means taking duals, and this is a contravariant functor. Because when we reverse the orientation of the objects, then suddenly we have to consider the cobordism going the other way. And likewise in the category of Hilbert spaces, in that case it corresponds to taking duals. So this for this we don't need to consider Hilbert spaces, we can just consider vector spaces. So just forget the scalar product. Then we take the dual vector space, and then we also can consider the dual of the linear map, which then goes, so if we have a linear map from V to W, the dual goes from a vector space W, from the dual of W to the dual of V, right? And so this is part of the structure that this functor is also supposed to preserve this duality. So this is duality on the level of objects, and there's also duality on the level of morphisms, which corresponds to reversing, in this case of the cobordism, corresponds to reversing the orientation of the cobordism, so on the level of the morphisms. And if we do that, if I have a morphism from this, well, sigma 1 to sigma 2, the opposite manifold is going to be, so cobordism meaning that we have this manifold M here, whose boundary we identify with sigma 1 union sigma 2 opposite orientation, right? So the bar meaning opposite orientation. So now if we reverse the orientation of M, that means its boundary we can identify with the opposite orientation of sigma 1 union sigma 2. So this means it's now a morphism going from sigma 2 to sigma 1. And likewise in Hilbert spaces, when we have a linear map from a Hilbert space K to from a Hilbert space H to a Hilbert space K, and we apply the dagger, we get a linear map going from K to H, right? And part of the structure of those functors, so we require these functors to preserve both of these dualities.
So, but the question was that the unitary. So, I mean, somehow they don't think everything is invertible for one thing. If the topology changes,
yeah,
one
yeah.
system, if you're thinking about, they might change the number of degrees of freedom, maybe or something, and then you can bring it back. So, I mean, bounded linear maps, I guess, supposed to be more general, where you can maybe correspond to like
mm-hmm.
more channels, like quantum channels, rather than, I mean, sort of the idea. I mean, maybe not exactly, but Is it, does it like something generalize a little bit where you can have some mix?
Yeah.
So, but I think feel like our time is running out, so we should probably go on with the agenda a little bit.
Right. Yeah. I just wanted to mention this problem as one of the things that should be understood, that this time evolution is not the unitary, but still in some way it has to be compatible with the Dagger structure.
Can I say something? I'm not sure, but you know, the unitary here is the time evolution unitary, is that right? So like in my language or my understanding is that if the series unitary means the whole series doesn't have, like a ambiguous decay, like particle decay and then goes nowhere. Like it's a unitary evolution of time or something, and particle doesn't decay. And that's one thing I think the way I understand unitary. And I also heard one thing about TQLT is that I guess there are two ways to think of TQLT. One is like Witten type, the other is Schwarz type. And I heard that the Schwarz type, like Transimon or BF theory, is still unitary. And Witten type, there is some twist making the unitary.
But you
have to be a bit careful
of it, because so also in this thesis he's saying that a TQFT is called unitary.
Yes.
So this functor here is called unitary if it preserves both of those dualities. So this does not say that the time evolution is unitary.
It's a deeper definition.
Yeah.
But how about the Schwarz type or Witten type? That definition is the same as this one or the one I say.
Yeah.
I guess this is the one I say, right?
I don't know.
Should we investigate that another time?
That's
maybe?
Yeah.
Maybe someone can prepare and say tell us some
story
about it.
Yeah. I guess it's also good to look at this and when we have a better understanding of the examples.
Mm.
Now,
who wants to go first? I guess it's very different stuff. So
let's see the usual kind of more like functional integral definition of GQFTs and basic examples.
Yeah.
I have the feeling that we might run out of time. I mean, that we just hear him today and then he will be next week. Yeah.
Okay. So I will not really try to fit in my example into that framework, because you know the frameworks. I just want to give an example where to tell you why these TQFTs appear in physics, and how can I characterize them? You know, if I'm given a theory, how can I say whether it's topological or not? So it's more the kind of thing that I'd like to discuss. So one of the easiest examples is BF theory. And so the history that people noticed in lattice gauge theories a long time ago, you know, doing it on the lattice, that at zero coupling, they had some kind of fancy phase which exhibit some kind of topological effects. But people somehow ignored that, to some extent, because they had the asymptotic safety freedom and so on. So they had lots of other stuff to do. But then Whedon came with his analysis of Transimons. I think it's 88. And so that's an example of an exactly solvable though nonlinear theory. And it has to do with algebraic topology. linear things. So many mathematicians then came and they had lots of work, you know. And basically, Whelan exhibited some really nice connection between algebraic topology and field theories. It was the kind of revolution.
So which aspect of algebraic topology?
Sorry?
Which aspect? Which aspect?
Of algebraic topology?
Which aspect?
Well, finding that if you consider these field theories, you look at the partition functions or scattering amplitudes, and you find that they're related to topological invariants. They can be expressed in terms of topological invariants.
So, for example, in the case of knot theory, I suppose we can take a knot, we can embed it in the three sphere, and consider the complement, and apply the TQFT to that, and then we get an invariant of the knot.
No, typically, I mean, maybe it's just like what you say, but in practice, what I remember that if you take Chern-Simon theory on the three sphere. And so, Chern-Simon theory is defined with a gauge field. So you take a knot and look at the Wilson line, the Wilson loop along this knot, and then the expectation value. And this is a Jones polynomial.
Okay.
So I'm not going really through that because it's complicated.
Yeah.
So that was actually a Pitts medal. And so that works in 3D. So that's in 3D. And also, Whelan had some analysis of 3D gravity as a Chern-Simon theory. And the paper is really nice. Maybe I can give you the reference. That's called topology changing. Topology changing amplitudes in 2+1 dimensional gravity. For a nice paper. And for BF theory, so it was introduced 1 year after this development in 89 by Horowitz and independently Blau and Thompson.
That's not the piano.
Sorry?
Horowitz.
Horowitz?
He has famous
piano.
Gary
Horowitz.
Yeah.
It's not the same one.
Probably too much.
And there's a nice introduction to BF theory by John Bass, which the reference is GRQC. 99.05.07. It's a nice introduction, but it's mostly classical, just like what I'm going to do. And if you want the quantum theory, well, you can look at the Blau and Thompson paper or this paper by Whelan, for example. Right here. Is it okay for you if
I
write? I
have a question.
Yeah, sure.
So just one request. Will you today connect this to like flat connections?
Definitely.
So that's okay.
That's what I'm going to do.
Good. Yeah. I want to use it next.
So M is a d-dimensional manifold. G, a Lie group. Okay, semi has to be compact, semi-simple, or
very nice
Lie. Yeah, a very nice Lie group. Because typically it's SU2 or SUN. I take a G bundle over M. A is a connection on it. And so now I have introduced a G bundle, so I will get rid of it by writing things locally. Okay, so that's what physicists do.
Yeah.
We introduce the mathematical objects and then forget about them. So locally, my connection, I write it like a mu dx mu, and I put some index I that lives in the Lie algebra. So ji, where ji is a generator. So it's a G valued one form where this funny G is going to be. Okay, the curvature. F is EAI plus FIJK AJ wedge AK, where these coefficients here are the structure constants of the Lie algebra. And I sum over repeated indices. Okay, so now BF theory is a very boring theory because this is a theory for the equations F equals zero. So it looks like very boring, and all my explanations will kind of tend to that point. But once you look at them globally, it's very interesting. Once you look at them globally. Okay, so now I can build to build the action.
Okay, I think you can remove it. Even though they are.
There's some eraser.
On the top of the books. I'm not very familiar with field theory. Can you tell me how many, what range does the I run through?
So it's the dimension of the group.
Okay.
So.
Or the dimension of the Lie algebra.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So also I take so the curvature is a two form because I take dA and then A wedge A. So now to build some nice action, I take B, G valued B minus two form, and I'm going to use it as a Lagrange multiplier to impose that equation. So the action is a function of B and A, and it's an integral of M. So on my Lie algebra, I have some inner product because the group is semi-simple. So
so B is also dynamical?
Yeah. I mean, it's a Lagrange multiplier. So whether you want to call it dynamical or not.
Yeah.
It's up to you, but it's a field. B, I, wedge, F, I, basically. So the repeated I here just means that you use the inner product on your Lie algebra. I don't want to introduce fancy notation for it, so.
Actually, I want to say,
Yeah.
So one can also not just take f as a two-form field space, maybe define a as higher form, not just one form. I don't know whether in that case you can also call this BF theory. So you can write down like B wage dA, but A is some P form, not necessarily one.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's true, that's true.
But is there a reason, is there a reason that one focus on this case? Is that because you want to cover?
So I don't know what happens for, I mean, it makes sense to define
yeah,
what you're saying, but I don't know the resulting theory. In that case, I know I can solve it exactly. And the tools I'm using, they're really related to the fact that A is one form.
Yes.
I really need that here. Because I'm going to integrate A
yes.
to get holonomies and map and homomorphism from the fundamental group to G and this kind of thing. So, I mean, I'm not sure how far I really want to go there, but looks like it's essential actually here.
And also, maybe, I just don't know, if you use something else as an A, you're not, it's not necessary that you, I mean, the F, it will be not a curvature anyway. So if you change that, actually we want that the curvature to be vanishing, the curvature of your manifold.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, if you take B wedge dA, where A is a P form and B a D minus P minus one,
okay.
Then I mean, you still have dA equals zero. It's not F equals zero, it's dA equals zero. So,
so the solutions of the classical field equation, when I consider those modular gauge invariants, then we get precisely the.
I would describe them.
Okay.
Precisely.
Good.
just before. before going to the equation of the motion, I want to tell you that this field theory is related to some very well-known field theories. Like, this is exactly Young-Mills at zero coupling. So to see that, you can write the Young-Mills action as integral f with star f, where star is the Hodge dual on the manifold. And you have the BF Young-Mills action, which is BF plus one over g squared b wedge star b, and because it's quadratic in b, if you look at the equations of motion, it, you know, take the variation with respect to b, so you get f roughly equals to star b. Okay, so when you plug it back in the action, you extract b, which is equals to star f. And you're back to here. You have to solve for B, plug the results, and you're back to the Young-Mills action.
So have you promoted now B into a gauge field itself?
It's a D minus two.
So
form.
Yeah.
And so to go from here.
So this is in four dimensions then only, or
no arbitrary dimensions.
So how does the action, the last action correspond to the Young-Mills action?
So what you, so
did you identify the B with star
yeah,
B with
solve,
the wedge?
Solve B as a function of A.
Oh, okay.
And plug it back here. And this is actually B equals, I don't know, minus G squared star F. With a two. G squared. So when you plug it back, you get the, I think. Or you can do the path integral if you prefer. Because it's quadratic, it's picked on the classical
mm-hmm.
solution.
Yeah.
So.
Is that thing inside?
One over G
thing?
Squared.
Oh, sorry.
One.
Yeah, thank you.
Is that thing, like in the integrand, is that a d minus 1 form?
So here it's d minus 2 plus 2, which gives d.
Okay, but up there, bi, fi, also.
Hmm?
Like the one, the first line.
Yeah, here.
Yeah. No,
above this action.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah,
yeah,
you're saying, what is it, you say it's deform?
Deform.
Yeah. B, B is D minus 2 and F is 2.
2.
Two.
F,
oh.
D, A.
F, because F, F is D, A. And
A
squared. So F is 2.
How does JI, what does it do? Just coefficients. Just coefficient, that just does
no.
Coefficients.
A is one form, F is D, A. D, A is 2.
Yeah. A is a one form and F are just coefficients.
The GI are the algebra generators.
If you will trace on it, there's actually a trace for cancelling modes.
Yeah.
It's a very big notation up there, but yes, you take the sort of scalar product on the algebra for.
Yeah. I mean, I can write a scalar product, but then I have to forget the wedge, so either I have to emphasize one of them. So this is the zero coupling limit of Young-Mills, and that's why people actually saw it in lattice gate theories for decades ago. So in 3D general relativity, the action is something like that, where E is a one form. So it's exactly of the BF type plus some cubic term here, but actually the cubic term does not affect the topological behavior, so it's still a topological field theory, 3D general relativity. And in 4D, GR, so the most interesting case in four dimension is
so in the GR case, this E is a triad, which plays then the role of B.
Exactly, exactly. It's a one form. So the action for the GR, I mean, I'm removing all the SL2C indices, right? So I'm writing just the forms. It looks like E wedge F plus lambda E four times. So if I put B equals E wedge E, you see I have some kind of BF action, a BF term plus a B squared term.
When did the E disappear?
Sorry?
Where did the E's come from?
So that's the tetrad, the Fermat of general relativity. So I'm just here writing the action for GR, and I'm just saying it looks very close to BF theory. If you take BF theory with B equals E wedge E. But actually, not all B fields can be written as E wedge E. So when you integrate with respect to all B fields, you get a topological field theory. But if you integrate only over the tetrad, it's not topological. You have gravitons. So that's why I wanted the kind of things that I wanted to describe using the equations of motion. So before going to some quantum thing, you can just ask yourself, what is topological field theory at the classical level? How do I see it? Because like in this action for general relativity, I don't have any metric. I just need some differentiable manifolds. All right? So it looks like what's the difference between this and BF theory? They're both diffeomorphism invariants, both written just only using differential forms.
Well, the tetrad is then the metric, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it's a dynamical field.
Yeah.
It's a one form, and I don't have any metric. So you can build a metric from the tetrad, but I don't need a metric to write the action.
Yeah.
That's what, yeah. Uh-huh. So to see difference, you have to look at the equations of motion. Oh yeah, and I forgot to say, you can have interesting things if you couple, let's say, transimons, which, and BF in 3D is a kind of transimon theory. So in 3D, you can couple transimons with QED, and you get interesting things related to quantum Hall effect, I think. I don't know much about that.
What's the GED?
QED? That's the Q. Yeah, I'm sorry.
sorry, maybe just my ignorance. Can you remind me how this ProDGR works? You want to write this in terms of some rich scalar, is it? No.
Yeah, so. Yeah, the Hilbert Einstein Hilbert action is integral square root of g
yes.
minus g r.
Yes.
So it looks different, yeah, I agree. So what did you do? E is something that I should write E mu I dx mu j I, where I is some R4 index,
yes.
if you want. And then I can build a metric g mu nu
yes.
doing that. Using the Minkowski
yes.
metric here.
Yes.
And the point that here E and the connection are independent variables. So
okay.
you have to solve one of the equations of motion.
Yes.
So that you only have E or G
yes.
as a fundamental variable.
Yes.
And then you can see the action reduces to that one.
Yes.
So you have to solve one of the you have to solve the connection.
Yes. Okay, understand. So ever something like the E something the E D E something. That would be related to some curvature.
So the equation is dA of
the
E equals zero. So it's equivalent to saying that A is the Levi-Civita connection for the metric.
What's the relation between B of Yang-Yel and
Yang-Yel's? So you take that action,
uh-huh.
where you have two independent fields, the B field
yeah.
and the connection.
Uh-huh.
So you write the equations of motion,
uh-huh.
We find that B equals that stuff, okay? And then you come back here and insert the result. So you set
so
B equals blah, blah, blah,
you
and you get that.
Okay.
You get the first one.
I mean, you already solve something, like
yeah.
Minimize some action or something once.
Yeah.
Okay,
but B of Yang-Yel is not the same as B, right? Because you
no,
made
yeah,
a Yang-Yel.
Yeah, yeah.
So
because you have that term, which depends on the metric explicitly because of the Hodge operator. So it's different. And yeah, you know, Yang-Yel's has local degrees of freedom, the gluons. But in BF theory, what I'm just going to show you is that there's no local degrees of freedom.
But you added another B-wedged.
Yeah.
B-wedged. Hodge star B, then in essence it's not the same as B, right? Because also you have B squared.
Exactly, exactly.
So it's still not BF.
Exactly. BF is a topological feature because it has some enhanced gauge symmetries.
Yeah.
But this term breaks the enhanced gauge symmetry. So it's not topologically invariant, especially because of that B squared term.
Yes. But this is essentially just putting in the like passing the performance like integrate our B field, right?
Exactly.
But
so you can,
it's not that magical, right? So I don't know why people say Yang-Yel and BF relation is so important. But because you add a B squared term already.
I mean, we call it BF Yang-Yel's.
Yes, yes.
It's not BF.
It's not BF.
It's Yang-Yel's in a different formulation.
I know. Okay.
That some people call it the first order formulation. Because B and A are canonically conjugated.
Okay.
Do you mean that he reduces to Yang-Yel problem, but set a different one? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
I mean, it doesn't bring lots of insight. It's just that typically, if you look at zero coupling here, you're a bit annoyed because you have 1/g². So when g goes to zero, what's happening?
Okay.
So if you look at that formulation, it's much clearer.
Yes.
Okay. You take g squared to zero and you have BF.
Yes.
Okay.
It's like the covering the Riemann sphere with two charges. I mean like in one limit you solve it one way and the other limit you solve the other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Okay, so let me look at the equation of motion.
So, but using the same reasoning, we could also get B wedge star F, no? And then B would be F the same.
Yeah.
I mean, and
yeah,
the
I can
section F
B.
And then star F kind of play equivalent roles.
Oh, yeah, sure. Definitely. Makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. That's true. I could redefine B. So if I look at delta S by delta B, would be a fraction, I get F equals 0. Okay. I'm not so surprised. This is what I wanted. If I look at delta S by delta A, so that's B wedge delta F by delta A. And so you have to calculate that guy, it's not so hard. You get B wedge dA of delta A. Yeah, I'm not sure I defined dA. This is the covariant derivative, which is D plus A, basically. Are you okay with that relation? Awesome. Oh.
Is A some kind of connection, or am I
missing
the
point? Sorry? Yeah, A was, is A some kind of connection, or am I missing the point? It is a connection.
Right,
okay. Definitely.
It's like a
generalized result, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. So let's say dA of B is dB plus commutator of A and B. That's what I mean.
That's good.
It's a bit more explicit, by the way. And so then you can do, so this covariant derivative behaves like a normal one. So I can do integration by parts. So this is minus dA of B, which delta A. So my equation of motion is dA of B equals 0.
It just designed to make that definition.
Yeah. My second equation after integration by after integrating by parts is dA of B equals 0. So I just want to understand the solutions of that equation, of those equations. So locally, F equals 0 means that A is 0 up to gauge. Locally. Okay, so then the second equation becomes dB equals 0. So locally, so it means that B is a closed form, so locally it's exact. B equals D guy. So it's an exact form. So now let me just come back to the initial action and notice that what happens if you look at the action for B plus dA of some eta and A. So I just shift the B field with dA of something. Yeah.
B less than what representation of the gauge group?
It lives in the Lie algebra.
Okay, because then this when we take this in a
bracket
in the Lie algebra.
Yeah. It's a G-valued field.
Uh-huh.
So I can so if eta is also a G-valued field, I take dA of eta and shift B like that. It's B plus dA of eta, which F. So I get the BF for B and A. And another part. And I can do an integration by part, which gives me minus eta wedge dA of F. Now you can check that this is identically zero for any connection. This is called the Bianchi identity.
Mm-hmm.
So it means that the action is invariant when I shift B by some by dA of something. Yeah, definitely. We'll go. This is where we get. So in particular, locally, my solution of the equations of motion for the B field is some exact form. So I can shift it by exactly its opposite without changing the actions and the physics. So locally.
Before going, you always using integration by part. You don't care about surface term stuff like this.
No, because I'm in the bulk. I'm looking at excitations, local excitations in the bulk.
Okay.
So I do have boundary terms.
Okay.
But they live on the boundary. So.
All right.
So I don't care about them right now.
Sorry. Like really a field theory, you mean? So you don't.
Yeah.
Okay.
So locally, all solutions are, they are like A equals 0 and B equals 0. So I have built a nice theory. But globally, it's a bit different. And this is where cohomology enters the game. And maybe I should stop after that. So if F equals 0, you can calculate that dA squared acting on some vector. This is F commutator of F with B. So if F is 0, it means that dA squared is 0. So I can build cohomology classes for dA. Now obviously A is locally zero up to gauge, but globally it's a non-trivial object. So you have to remember that. So it's some you get some twisted Durham cohomology.
Because you're using the covariant derivative this time, is what you mean by twisted? No.
Yeah, twisted means that it's not D, it's DA.
Yeah, so it's the same thing. So it won't work. It's so like if you stick in DA, it won't work with it. If you stick in DA, that you have the same result that the does not, that eta, like it doesn't work. Does it?
If I just put d eta,
yeah.
It doesn't work.
Right. So it's sensitive to what's happened in definition of f, sort of.
Definitely.
So by taking the variation over a, you get the dA of b is 0.
Yeah.
How did you get dA of f is 0? Did you show it today?
This?
Uh-huh.
No, I'm not showing it today.
Oh, you just
this is just identically 0. For any connection, and it's called the Bianchi identity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Is this twisted cohomology? Is that anything like having torsion in the metric, or is
completely different? Yeah,
completely different. Right.
That's a twisted. that's a notion of twisted used by mathematicians.
This
right.
is like
what Cecilia was saying. Is that the same notion of twist as
Cecilia? Oh, no.
No, I think
it's... Now I'm really lost.
Is it like...
And where it's confusing that from this twisted cohomology, you can define a torsion.
But they're not the same thing.
But it's not the torsion of the metric. It's the torsion of a complex of good chains.
Yeah.
So it's a little different.
Okay. Is it like sheaf homology with values in the principal bundle or something like that?
Yeah, so the forms, there are forms on the manifold and
sure.
valued in the layout graph.
Yeah. No,
to define things really properly, you should use the bundle that I had in the beginning.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, but do you know if it's the same as some sort of sheaf cohomology then?
I think you may be able to use that language. Yeah. I've seen a couple of papers.
Oh.
Starting with sheaves and
okay.
this kind of things. Yeah. If you want to prove properties on that cohomology, I guess you have to use sheaves.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there is a way to go from that to torsion in the metric, but it's not simple. It involves sort of changing levels.
Mm-hmm.
Some restriction.
There's no metric here, is there?
He just said that there's a way of going from this twisted Durand cohomology to find some kind of torsion on the metric. Presumably several stages to that definition.
No, which metric?
I'm sorry, I was confusing maybe.
Okay,
so you have a notion of
general relativity, and I'm trying to stretch that to follow this, right?
Okay.
So if I can't connect it to what I can remember from the general relativity course, I get lost very quickly.
I was just mentioning, because you mentioned torsion, I was saying that mathematicians, they have a notion of torsion, but it's not for the metric.
So
something
completely
different.
Right.
Okay, so it means that the solution are flat connections. Up to gauge.
Well, the Durand cohomology is always finite.
And for the B field, it has to satisfy dA of B equals 0 up to B becomes B plus dA of eta. So it's a closed form with respect to dA up to exact form with respect to dA. So B is by definition an element of the T minus 2 cohomology group for dA.
You mean, are you still locally?
No, that's globally. That connections up to gauge,
okay.
And that needs, that probes the topology. Locally, all solutions are equivalent to the zero solution, the trivial. So maybe I can discuss, I need like 3-4 minutes to discuss the Hilbert space. Because it's the same thing at the Hamiltonian level. So maybe you can do that now.
So a flat connection up to gauge is just the same thing as a principal bundle, right?
Yeah. Well, with a flat connection, it's not necessarily flat.
No, I mean a principal bundle without a connection. If I have such
okay.
a flat connection up to gauge, it defines a principal bundle.
Okay.
And conversely, on any principal bundle, I can choose a connection which is locally flat.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So if you want to know about the Hilbert space that I will associate to D minus 1 manifolds, I first have to go to Hamiltonian analysis that we do just by applying what I just told you here. So you just assume now that M is of the form sigma cross 0, 1, let's say. I mean, at least locally, you can slice M such the way that you have some patch like that. So D minus sigma is D minus 1 manifold. So obviously A restricts to a connection on sigma, or sigma times T if you want to be precise. And you have F of this A restricted to sigma, which is zero. This is just the restriction of the equation of motion to sigma, or to any slice sigma across T. And B also restricts to any slice, and you have dA of B, which is zero. So I just pull back everything on sigma. Now A is still a one form, B is still a D minus two form, but they live on a D minus one manifold. And so on sigma, H D minus two of dA restricted to sigma, you can use Poincaré duality to show that it's isomorphic to H1 dA on sigma. So you have, because it's a D minus 1 manifold, you have this Poincaré duality that relates H D minus 2 to H1. And the analysis is almost complete, because now what you have to do is, I mean, the directions I'm heading to is showing that you have a phase space of this, of the type T star or something, okay, cotangent bubble. Okay, so I want a phase space. I know that I have flat connections up to gauge, so I can denote that F divided by G, flat connections up to gauge. And so I don't know how familiar you are with that, but people in the thesis you showed me, they explain why, I mean, it's the group of homomorphism from the phenomenal group of sigma into G, divided by. So I don't know if you want more explanations, but the key point is then that the tangent space on a flat connection to that space, to F divided by G, so it's the tangent space on a given flat connection, this is precisely H1.
Really?
Yeah. And the way to see that is easy. Okay?
Okay.
It's easy. The way to see that you start with F equals zero. So you introduce a perturbation, let's say psi equals some delta A. Okay? That's a variations. So you're on, you have a flat connection in the set of all possible connections. You do variations. And you want that variation to be to preserve flatness, okay? So because you want tangent vectors to a set of flat connections, so you ask for delta F to be zero, you know? So you preserve flatness. So delta F, I told you that this is dA of delta A. Something you can check. DA of psi. And it's exactly the same equation as that satisfied by B, except that B is a D minus 2 form and psi is a 1 form. But you have Poincaré duality. So that shows that the tangent vectors to a set of flat connections are dual to the solutions for the B field. In other words, you really have a phase space. Does that make sense?
Almost very fast.
Phase space, like, what phase space do you mean, the contender?
Yeah.
That's the idea.
Yeah. So in the end, you have your set of flat connections, F by G. And so if you have a given flat connection A here, the tangent vectors should satisfy dA of delta I equals 0. And they are in correspondence with the B field. So that gives you the set of B fields in H1, basically. HD minus 2, but it's dual to H1. OK? So F, the set of flat connection, is sort of configuration space. And when you pick up a solution, a flat connection, look at tangent vectors. And these are the solution of my second equation of motion. So I satisfied two equations of motion, and I have a nice cotangent bundle, basically. So when I go to the quantization, I have to find the L2 spaces of flat connection, basically.
Does this dimension depend on A? What does that mean?
So H1 is typically a finite manifold, and finite dimensional, right? It can be actually a finite set of points, but it's finite dimensional in general. But L2, the square integrable functions on the set of flat connections, it's an infinite dimensional space. It's a space of functions. Would that be your question?
No, so this tension space, I mean, so H1 of,
yeah,
we take, I mean, the round
cohomology. Oh, this depends on A.
Yeah, the dimension depends on A.
That's a complicated question because that requires to study a set of flat connections on, you know, arbitrary manifolds in arbitrary dimensions, which is not possible. So, generically, if you think about it as a set of homomorphism from pi 1 to into G, then you can, if G is an algebraic group, then this is an algebraic variety.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's an algebraic variety, it has some stratification,
mm-hmm.
which means that there is, for most points, the rank of H1 does not depend on A.
Mm-hmm.
But there are singularities.
Mm-hmm.
There are some strata. So it's quite complicated, actually. So that's the classical theory. And once you know it, the quantization is more or less straightforward because you have your Hilbert spaces. And then you have to look at the path integral if you want the morphism. But the fact that it's well controlled at the classical level means that you have chances to do it right, to do it correctly at the quantum level. But doing it properly on the blackboard, that would require seriously at least an hour or so.
So that means we have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space in that case, right? Because we need to take
So
classical phase space of certain.
Exactly. So it's kind of the same thing for Chern Simons.
Mm-hmm. Why is it infinite dimensional?
The Hilbert space?
Yes. Because the manifold of classical configurations is already continuous. Then in order to quantize, you take L2.
I mean, the set of flat connections is a finite dimensional set, like manifold. So you can think of it, it's just like Rn. No, it's a continuous set. So when you quantize, right? So this is a field theory that is quite like quantum mechanics, because the classical solutions are just like classical physics.
Okay.
And you start with field theory, but the solutions tell you you only have finite number of degrees of freedom, classically. So when you quantize, it's just classical mechanics. It's just quantum mechanics, not quantum field theory.
And what's the, does it depend on the base manifold?
It does, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Because I'm confused that we know the statement, the ground state degeneracy of Trans-Simon or even BF series, finite dimension. And you know, any close.
Because I think you.
So I wonder, so why you kill the space will be.
Because the ground is finite,
because or what? Sorry?
Because. Are you dealing with finite group or compactly group?
No, it doesn't matter.
I mean, you have a compactly group and...
Yeah.
I think this statement about degeneracy of the ground state
is
related to a number of free parameters that label the ground state.
Okay.
So it has, I think, two parameters on the torus?
Yes, yes.
Because you have two cycles?
Yes, yeah, for BF.
And but that's the set of classical parameters. So when you quantize, you look at functions,
yes,
L squared functions,
yes,
on these two parameters, basically.
Yes.
So that's an infinite dimensional set of functions.
Yes. Okay.
But what is finite dimensional is the number of degrees of freedom, classically.
Is this a classical thing where I go down?
Or yeah, it's completely classical. But I wanted to emphasize that because if you are given a field theory and you have to say whether it's topological or not, it may be difficult. So one way to characterize them is to say that there's no local degrees of freedom. Locally, all solutions are equivalent to the trivial solution. And once you've done that, you have the full classical analysis. It reduces to a problem with finite number of degrees of freedom. So the quantization is a bit like quantum mechanics. It's not really quantum field theory.
Yeah.
Although you do it with the path integral, it's actually quantum mechanics because you have a finite set of moduli parameters, basically.
So also this, you said it. So this F modulo G is generically some sort of finite dimensional.
Yeah, it's not right by it.
It's
finite dimensional.
When you quantize, you get some special, like not very pure, like topological quantum field theory, or you get topological quantum field theory.
Yeah.
But they just somehow not very pure. Like, I mean, it's considered some.
Everything's defined in terms of field, but the set of independent parameters is actually finite dimensional.
Right. How do you hit a genuine topological quantum field theory?
Hmm?
How do you, you know?
All topological quantum field theory that I know, they have finite dimensional set of classical solutions.
Okay.
And because almost all of them rely on some cohomology rings.
Uh-huh.
And that requires usually that things are finite dimensional.
Yeah. That's a question.
Yeah.
Are we sure that we're all using the word dimension in the same way? Right. I mean, this is not right. Can I give you an example?
Yeah.
If I have a one-dimensional system like a string, okay, that's a 1D object.
Mm-hmm.
But if I look at all the set of continuous functions on there, right, like say setting up Fourier analysis or what have you, then I model that as an infinite-dimensional space.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Right. So there's two different senses in which the word dimension is being used here.
Mm-hmm.
Right, one of which happens to be, well, in this case, one, you can do this with a sheet as well, and the other case is infinite.
So
many,
here?
It might even be countable.
Yeah, so the classical configuration space is finite dimensional, and then when we quantize that, we go to the space of functions over that, so we get an infinite dimensional.
Exactly.
So yeah, you're kind of thinking, what do we mean by this word dimension here, because it might not be all the same.
Both.
Yeah, so the set of flat connections modulo gauge is finite dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
But when you quantize, you get L2 of F by G. And I mean, that's an infinite dimension space because it's a set a space of functions. I mean, this can be like the real line, for example, here. Like if you take the torus, it's going to be R2 or compactified R2.
Right.
It's finite dimension.
It's either one of those senses of the word dimension the same as topological dimension, or is that a different sense again? So remember Lee burbling on about how you can have topological quantum field theories which have a topological dimension but have no notion of distance, right? And so I'm not quite sure how that works.
What's the topological dimension?
I don't know.
I don't know. I've heard about it, but I can't remember.
Lee Smiley. I went to his quantum gravity course ages ago, and I don't remember very much about it, but I do remember that.
one more question. So how, in deriving that line, the cotangent space is the same as H1 or something, how did you go about it? Did you go about it describing what's in H1 and then showing that they can be interpreted as cotangent vectors?
Good point, I have to remember.
On the lower right corner, no?
I do two things.
Yeah.
Okay. One thing is, I know that I have this equation. I know that the solutions lie in HD minus 2, which is dual to H1.
Okay.
So I know that my solutions are flat connections up to gauge and elements of H1, basically. Then I want to see that it's a cotangent bundle.
Okay.
So what I do is I come back to the flat connections, look at tangent vectors, and I realize that they indeed lie in H1.
Oh, so actually H1 is the tangent bundle, where as soon as we go to H2 we get the
It's finite problem. Dimensional, and I can have some inner product, so I don't really care.
Yeah, okay, but I mean we don't fix the metric, right?
Yeah. So indeed, if you want some inner products, you need to fix a metric. But if you want to do the path integral quantization, you also need a metric. So if you want to do things with it, because you have to gauge fix, basically. But there's a way to do without metrics all the way through, which is to go on the lattice. And then if you go on the lattice, everything's finite dimensional from the beginning, and it has inner products coming from the SU2 or SUN in the products. So there you don't really care whether it's dual, it's tangent, cotangent.
And in the case of this 3D HDR, we basically get three-dimensional quantum gravity in that way.
Exactly. So this is the paper by Witten that I mentioned.
Oh,
okay. And so in that paper by Witten, he explains the quantum theory. So, to each cobordism, you have a kernel associated, which gives you the way you map the one eatable space to the other one. And he describes that kernel in terms of the torsion of the cohomology ring, basically.
But this is our cohomology over R, no? Coefficients in R?
No, in the Lie algebra.
Yeah, okay, but still, I mean,
yeah.
Torsion, you don't mean torsion in the sense of something which becomes zero when we add it to itself a certain number of times?
No, it's not that.
Oh, it's not, okay. It's a third sense of torsion.
Yeah, definitely.
Torsion in the sense of cohomology. Cochains. Sometimes I can twist it
between
two sectors, the Lie algebra sectors and the differentiable section in the cochain.
It's the raising.
And the way that you act on the differentiation, it can intertwine the two concepts. So this is what they call torsion in the sense.
That's the Ray-Singer torsion, if you know about that, if you heard about that.
That's some kind of invariant topology.
So the kernel, well, you see that the kernel that I mean, that's the basis of, I mean, the key ingredient of your functor, because that's the map between Hilbert spaces, is it's basically an integral of your flat connections of some topological invariant.
So when we apply this to a closed manifold, we just get a number. And this number is?
The.
So the partition function?
So yeah, it's the partition function.
And that is the Reis singular torsion?
Yeah, and it's the integral of the Reis singular torsion of the all flat connections.
Oh, so the torsion depends on the connections though.
Yeah. And if you do it on the lattice, you have a combinatorial version that's due to Touref, called the combinatorial torsion. Or the Heidemeister torsion. So you have many torsions, but they're all equivalent. So, I mean, this is more involved. That's why I emphasize the classical parts.
If we want to come back to just for 1 second to, to category. So here, is it the sigma that we will use, because it's just a trivial anyway in the other direction. So should we use that sigma here and that phase space, the L2 function on that H1? I mean, on is it that as?
Yeah. Okay. So you take sigma 1, sigma 2, and on both of them you have the space of square integrable functions over flat connections. So the set of flat connections depends on sigma 1, sigma 2. Take the L squared function on them. And then you have an operator that goes from one to the other.
Mm.
And the kernel is given by a topological invariant, this combinatorial torsion, or Reis singular torsion.
The kernel of what?
Of the operator. So the operator,
which operator?
That goes between hyperspaces and the TQFT.
Oh, yeah, okay, that one.
Yeah.
So you have sigma 1.
So the image of that covert is.
Sorry?
So the image of covert is in your column.
Yeah. So you have your covertism here, and so on sigma 1, you have L2 F by G.
Are you intentionally drawing the trivial cover?
No, that's a mess.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So there's some holes and stuff. Yeah.
Projecting it onto a two-dimensional blackboard, which might be
exactly. So it's too complicated for me to draw.
Yeah.
But you can kind of gesticulate, but that tends to be confusing.
Exactly. And here you have L2 of F over sigma 2 by G, like that. And here you have an operator.
Yeah.
Morpheus, okay.
Yeah. So basically, so let me take some coordinate X here and some coordinates Y here. Okay. Then my operator does something, I mean, it has a kernel. Like that. Okay. And if I took psi in that space, I get another, so I can write integral dx, k of y x, psi of x. And that gives me a state that lives here. Okay. So I take a state, which is a function with coordinates x here. So I integrate it against that kernel. And it depends on the coordinates on the set of flat connections on
that
sigma 2.
Kind of kernel, not a kernel.
Yeah, okay.
So that gives you a state. I don't know how you want to call it. Phi of y.
Yeah. All right.
But it's a function of psi, okay?
Yes.
It's defined. So this phi
depends on
is in L2 of F on sigma 2
yeah.
by G. And phi, if you want, you can write it as, I don't know, how do you want to call the operator here?
Capital F. It should be existing Z. It should.
Z
yeah.
or
it can
yeah.
be Z
or
so.
Z or what, how you
call
the
manifold,
that is
M.
M
for yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a way okay, no.
So that's a relation between functions
mm-hmm.
and the relation more explicitly is exactly that. Phi of y is some integral of the initial states psi against some kernel.
Mm-hmm.
And the kernel here, it's a topologically invariant.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you mean by a topological invariant as a kernel? Which kind of transformation leave it invariant?
Well, homeomorphism.
Okay.
It's
if
a
you,
topological
if you,
invariant.
Okay. If you move the guy inside, you do a homeomorphism of X.
I take another manifold that is homeomorphic to that one.
Right. Okay.
So they have the same boundary. I have, and I can look at the kernel,
yep.
and there are the same objects.
Okay. So that specific, that restricted class of guy that you can imagine, or is it always group anything that I can choose?
No, I mean, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
This kernel I can define is explicitly going on the lattice.
But
if I have a lattice, I can write it explicit, very explicitly.
If you take a manifold sigma two guys, okay. Let me see on the bottom. It has a particular pi one, okay.
Yeah.
It has some generators. Can I split? I mean, can I split the L two in terms of kind of bunches of those guys, like Bazzi, the basis of something. You know,
I would like to see,
for instance, if I check just the circle on the bottom, okay, I take the circle on the top, let me take the identity, with the flat guy.
Yeah.
What's